We are in a new series in this last part of John's Gospel. We've looked at parts of John's Gospel in chunks over the last couple of years. And now for about 8 weeks, we will look at this last section, what's often called the Passion Narrative, which is the story of Jesus' death and resurrection as John tells it. And we're calling this series The King is Dead for reasons that we'll see. The section, as I said, is often called the Passion Narrative, which is fitting because in this part of John's Gospel, we see Jesus' passion and the extent of his passion for the world, for you and me. As we look at this passage that John Simpson just read for us, different John, wasn't the one who wrote the Gospel, as we look at this section that he just read for us, we'll see Jesus' passion in a profound way, I think. So will you pray with me now and ask God to help open our eyes and humble our hearts to see what he's saying to us. Lord, please do humble our hearts, open our eyes, help us to see your Son in all his glory. Amen. As we start off this passage, it's page 1084 of the Blue Bibles. Start off at the big 18 there, chapter 18, the start of chapter 18. And we're swept into the scene of Jesus leading his disciples over the Kidron Valley into a garden, which was probably an olive grove. And as it starts there, it says, when he'd finished praying. Because all of this actually happens immediately after the great prayer that Jesus prays in chapter 17, the prayer for his glory, for his 12 disciples, and for all who would follow him. And that prayer is itself the end of an evening that he spent teaching his disciples, preparing them for his departure, which he said was about to happen. And when he said that prayer and he gave that preaching, he was somewhere in the city of Jerusalem, map of Jerusalem. But now, at the start of our passage today, he's taking his disciples across the Kidron Valley, which you see highlighted there, and then into this little garden, or this olive grove that I've highlighted in red. The other Gospels call this garden Gethsemane, which means oil press, olive oil. So that's why it all fits together. It's this olive grove, this garden, this Gethsemane. So here he is in this garden with his disciples, having prayed for them and taught them. The scene is set. And so we get to see our first point. There is an outline in your welcome sheets if that helps. We get our first point, the world is against him. The world is against Jesus. And it doesn't seem like it at this point, you're probably thinking. Here he is in with his disciples in this idyllic olive grove in the Middle East. But then, verse 2. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. Judas, who betrayed him. Doesn't sound too good, does it? Judas had left the disciples, the group of disciples, some time ago and gone away to run an errand, but in fact gone to the Jewish authorities. And Judas knew the place where Jesus had taken his disciples. He knew this garden. He knew that Jesus would probably go there. And so verse 3, he guides an arresting party to Jesus. But it's striking who the Gospel writer John points out was in this party, this arresting party. There are actually three groups. You see these three groups? Firstly, there's a detachment of soldiers. And these were almost certainly Roman soldiers who were in Jerusalem at that time. There was the Passover at that time. It was crowds and crowds flocked to Jerusalem from elsewhere. The place became quite rowdy sometimes. And so the Romans would station extra soldiers at Passover to make sure things didn't get out of hand. And so we've got a group of these soldiers, these Romans, the great world power, coming to arrest Jesus. That's the first group. Then you have the second group, who it says are some officials from the chief priests and the Pharisees. So the chief priests and the Pharisees were the Jewish leadership. And these officials were most likely some kind of temple police that they sent to arrest Jesus. So you've got the Romans, you've also got the Jews coming to arrest Jesus. And something that, as 21st century readers, we might miss in our ignorance, is that when you have Romans and Jews together, you effectively have the whole world represented. The reason I say that is because, from a biblical point of view, there are two basic groups in humanity. There are the Jewish people on one hand and the Gentiles on the other. And Gentiles basically means the non-Jews. So they are the two basic groups of the human world from a biblical point of view. So when you see representatives of the Jewish leadership and a force from the great Gentile world power, the Romans, and they're arrayed together against Jesus, it represents the whole world against Jesus. John's showing us a little picture of the whole world going to arrest Jesus to take him away, the world against him. And you may be thinking, that's a bit much. Come on, the whole world against Jesus? You might even think, well, for a start, I'm not against him. I think Jesus is a good teacher. I think he was probably a good man. Or you may even just be not too sure what you think about Jesus, but you might say, I like what he seems to represent, loving your neighbour, not judging, so I'm not against him. Trouble is, Jesus won't quite let us away with that. See, as I said, we've looked at this gospel in a few chunks over the last couple of years, and we've seen Jesus make some extraordinary claims. For instance, a little while ago, we heard him say this in John chapter 14. He said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. He was claiming to be the one true way to God. And that might sound like an exclusive, kind of almost arrogant claim. But the thing is, what he was saying was, we're all in desperate need of a bridge, a way, a road to get to God, but there aren't any. Our own rebellion against God has cut us off, and our natural desire to run things our way without God, to go after other things instead of God, that separates us from God. But Jesus says, I am the way. I am this bridge, this way to God. And that's why no one comes to the Father except through him. Because apart from him, there's no other bridge. There's no other true way to God. But Jesus says that he can truly offer us this way to get to God. He makes that extraordinary claim. That's not my words, they're his. And then it turns out, he makes this claim because of who he is. So at a number of points in the gospel, he makes these big calls about his own identity. And we saw one again today, in today's passage. Did you notice it? When that arresting party came, Jesus asked who they're looking for. They said, Jesus of Nazareth. And he replied in verse 5, I am he. And the weird thing that happened in verse 6, where they kind of draw back and fall to the ground, strange little occurrence. But that strange occurrence happens because when Jesus says, I am he, literally it's just, I am. And I am was the name God used for himself in the Old Testament. He was the great I am. And this is a name that Jesus had applied to himself various times in the gospel, over and again saying in a slightly subtle way, but only slightly subtle, I am the I am. When you see me, says Jesus, you see God himself in the flesh, come to earth, become one of you. And that's precisely why Jesus can create a bridge for us to God, because he's brought God to us so that we can be brought to God. Do you see the huge claims that he is making here and how important they are? And that means the idea that we could be, well, not really against him, kind of generally in favour, probably a good man, good teacher. I like some of what he stood for. I don't like all of what he's done. I don't like all of what he says, but I generally like it. Jesus just blows that out of the water. For any of us who might be inclined to sit on the fence a little bit when it comes to Jesus, And I'm a fence sitter generally on lots of things, but when it comes to Jesus, he rips the fence right out from under our backsides, I'm afraid. There's no fence because he takes it away. He's either who he said he is, God himself in the flesh, the only way to the Father whom we desperately need, or he's a crazy liar. He took the fence away. So when we say, I'm not really against him, and yet we don't recognize him as God himself, actually we are against him at that point because we're denying who he is. We're not really listening to him or recognizing him for who he is. And so to say the world is against him, as John is showing us here, the Romans, the great Gentiles, and the Romans who are the great Gentiles, and the Jews, the whole world against him, might sound strong, but actually John has shown us throughout it's actually the case. But more than that, it's not just the world. I said there were three groups. The third group are his own against him. Did you notice here how it points to Judas? Judas who betrayed him. It says it down again in verse 5. Judas, the traitor. Judas was one of the 12, one of those specially close to Jesus, who'd been with him for 3 years, traveling with him, living with him, eating and drinking, sharing life with him. And now here's Judas guiding the arresting party to Jesus, standing with those who are against Jesus. And part of what motivated Judas might have been kind of good intentions. He might have thought Jesus needed to be pushed to show his true power. He might have thought that Jesus had gone too far and needed to be sort of slowed down. He may have just grown disillusioned with Jesus and decided he thought he knew better than Jesus did. Whatever the case, one of Jesus' own was standing with the world against Jesus. It's not at all uncommon for Jesus' own people to betray Jesus and end up against him. The biggest enemy of Jesus can often be the church, seen throughout history. Many of us who are Christians here may be able to think of churches or Christians that we think are like Judas, siding with the world against the true Jesus. Maybe we'd be right about that. But we must not let ourselves off the hook too quickly. See, we've all got a little bit of Judas in us. If you think you don't, you definitely do. Sorry, that's true. Where do we find ourselves against Jesus? Where do we find ourselves not wanting to stand with him, but rather standing with the world? Perhaps thinking we know better than he does. Perhaps angry at him. I'm ashamed to say, I've often found myself angry with God, especially when things don't go the way I think they should go. Even sometimes, I must admit, I act in ways that I know are wrong, almost to spite God. Sort of saying, well, God, if you won't do this for me, or you won't do things the way I think you should, then I'm going to do this thing. At that point, I'm standing against Jesus. When do you find yourself standing against Jesus? The world was against Jesus. Even his own were in on it. But that's by no means the end of the story. It's just the start, actually. We're going to have to move through the rest of the story very quickly. While the world is against Jesus here, we also see Jesus' power over the world. Do you notice the way Jesus went out to those who were coming to arrest him? He didn't wait for them. He went out to them. Verse 4 says, Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, who is it you want? He knew what was going to happen, and he went to them. John really emphasizes this more than the other Gospels, in fact, because he doesn't want us to miss it. Jesus went to meet the crowd that was coming to arrest him. Now picture that. Here's just one man going out to meet a crowd who have lanterns and torches and weapons, verse 3, and there's these Roman soldiers. A full detachment of Roman soldiers was about 600 men. A subunit had about 200 in it. Even if the full subunit didn't go out to support the temple police, even if it wasn't a full subunit, you're still talking about a big armed crowd. And that's just the Romans, apart from the Jewish temple police. And then you have what we saw before. Jesus asks who they're looking for. They say, Jesus of Nazareth. He says those words, I am he, literally, I am. But as he says those words, the arresting party fall back because the power of his presence, the force of his words, as he speaks this sacred name, it's physically overpowering to this great armed crowd. Maybe you've experienced someone who has such a commanding presence that it's like they kind of take over a room when they walk into it. This is sort of like that, only supercharged and taking it to a level that only the Son of God can take it. So here's this man with the world against him, yet he knows exactly what is going to happen, and he can overpower those who are coming to get him with just his presence and his words. He's in complete control, has complete power over the situation, which is what makes the next thing so amazing. He gives himself up. That's what he's doing by going out to this arresting party. He's giving himself up to them. To those he has complete power over, giving himself up. The end of verse 8, he reiterates that he is Jesus of Nazareth. He's the one they're looking for. He does that so that they'll let these men, the other disciples, let them go. He does it to protect them, to protect his disciples. Verse 9, this happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled. I have not lost one of those you gave me. See, Jesus is protecting his people. He's caring for them. He's shielding them and saving them by giving himself up. Peter doesn't understand that for a start. He pulls out a sword, tries to fight in a very Peter kind of way. But Jesus, verse 11, tells him to put the sword away. He says, shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? See, he's given himself up to do what his Father had given him to do, what he knew he had to do. And so then, literally in verses 12 to 13, he gives himself up. They bind him. They take him to the authorities. And at this point, John drops this intriguing last verse in, verse 14. He says, Caiaphas, the high priest, was the one who had advised the Jewish leaders that it would be good if one man died for the people. Now, Caiaphas had done that way back in chapter 11 of John's Gospel. Why does John bring it up again here? Well, he does because it shows why Jesus is giving himself up. It shows what the cup that his Father had given him was all about. What it meant that he was protecting his people and not losing any of them. See, he was giving himself up not just to be arrested, but further to die. And to die for his people. Listen again to what John said about Caiaphas' words back in chapter 11. This is what John said about them. He said, Caiaphas did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. Do you see this? This is what Jesus was giving himself up for, to die for all the people. In fact, to die for the very ones who were against him. Because who was against him? The world. The whole world, even his own, were against him. And who did Jesus die for? Remember this famous verse from John's Gospel. For God so loved who? God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. The world was against Jesus. The world that condemned him, came to take him away and crucify him. That is who Jesus gave up his life for. He gave himself up to die for the very ones who nailed him to the cross. People like you and me. In all our rage against him, in all our ignoring of him, in all our sin against him, in all our indifference to him. He gave himself up for us, for you and me. There is only one response to that. Love and adoration of him. Giving ourselves up to him as he gave himself up for us. Because even when we hated him, when we stood against him, when we arrogantly thought we knew better than him, when we said no to him, he loved us to death. So we're going to sing now. We're going to sing a wonderful old hymn that expresses the wonder of this. And can it be that I should gain an interest in the Savior's blood? Died he for me who caused his pain? For me who him to death pursued? Amazing love. How can it be that thou, my God, shouldst die for me? Please stand.